There's hope for tomorrow. Some of us are glad 2017's about over, right? A lot of suffering and bad circumstances may have happened last year. So we look forward to tomorrow and we hope for the future. Future is where our hope is. Some people hope for the best, just don't expect it sometimes, right? Hope for the worst. Some other one said, prepare for the worst. In the latest Star Wars saga, I don't know if any of you've seen it, or those who haven't seen it yet, I don't want to blow it for you, because I'm going to give away a little bit of the story. You know about the Star Wars, the conflict, constant conflict, back and forth. And in this movie, we have the new Darth Vader, who's out to destroy the rebels and the rebel rebellion. They're part of the Empire. And they have followed them. And in the past, the forces would be able to escape many times by going into light speed and they would disappear. But they've now been able to track them through light speed. And so now they are on the verge of destroying them and they've escaped. The few remaining rebels have escaped to a planet, to a mountain, a fortress, defensive fortress. And Darth Vader and his forces have come to a point where they can annihilate them and to completely destroy the rebellion. They're in there and they're contemplating their demise and they consider that there is no hope. No hope. But of course, suddenly, Luke Skywalker comes to the rescue, right? Almost like a messianic deliverer who's going to provide a escape for them. And he battles Darth Vader and he's able to defeat them and give the rebellion a new life. In fact, it turns out that the Last Jedi really isn't the Last Jedi. And the battle will continue. And fortunately and conveniently for the movie theaters, or the movie makers, because they can continue to make more and more Star Wars movies, the conflict never seems to come to an end. Now, I thought that at the end of the third movie, which was actually the sixth movie in the whole saga, where they defeated the Empire, and there was a big celebration, I don't remember that, in the forest with the little EUs, whatever they call them, Ewoks, and the fireworks were going off, and everything. Okay. He thought, well, that's the end of the conflict, right? Nope. So I was thinking, this in a lot of ways is reminiscent of what Isaiah was talking about. We've seen in the vision of Isaiah, we see a doom to bloom. Out of doom is going to become a bloom. And he talked about in the movie, a spark. We need a spark. And I was thinking, well, we could have start singing, it only takes a spark to get a fire going. Anyway, I don't think they would appreciate it in a movie theater. So Isaiah, we see a doom to bloom and a light out of darkness. Now, just to summarize a little bit, Isaiah is a call to servanthood, how to become a useful, faithful, and righteous servant of God. How does sinful Israel become the servant Israel and become the destiny? In Star Wars, you know, join me and you will become the destiny that you have always been. How does Israel do that? The entire book is an appeal to abandon human pride, to trust in the Lord, accept His lordship, and to experience all of life as it was originally meant to be, a reflection of God's holy image and the role of a servant upon the earth. We've seen in the introduction of the book is chapters 1 through 5, where we see the present and future of God's people. Then we see in chapter 6 is the call to servanthood, where Isaiah sees a vision of God and God calls him to be the servant of God as a prophet. And then chapter 7 through 39, gives us the basis of servanthood. Whom shall we trust? Shall we trust in the man and in the nations, or shall we trust in God? Who is really trustworthy? All of those chapters go through all that. Now, chapters 1 through 5 are powerful, though general statement, of the hopes and realities of Judah's situation. The section moves back and forth between the two themes of doom and deliverance. Chapter 1, again, introduces the introduction. So you have an introduction and an introduction to the introduction. And it's the grand arraignment where God's going to, the Lord is going to, through Isaiah, present the charge. And the charge is abandoning the Lord, which is basically idolatry. They have broken primarily the first two commandments. Remember what the first two commandments are? God said, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, brought out of this land of slavery. Then he said, you shall have no other gods before me, and you shall make no other image of me. They have abandoned God and those two commandments, and they are now seeking the gods of their own making. Now, chapter 1 sets the stage for what follows. It declares the inevitable destruction or destructive results of forsaking God, the foolishness of rote religion, the necessity of justice, the corruption of leadership, through it all, the possibility of redemption, return, and restoration. Now, we see in chapter 1 the God's denunciation, the plea, and promise. The denunciation, I'm just summarizing here for you, writing notes down over there. God charge against Israel. Again, she has forsaken the Lord, abandoned the Lord, and as a result is broken and desolate. The plea for them is, then, God's plea for Israel to hear, receive instructions, take the only reasonable action, obedience and submission. They are to, therefore, listen, learn, and live, as verse 19 and 20 says, if you are willing and obedient, you shall eat the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you shall be devoured by the sword, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. So he's given them a choice. Listen, learn, or live, or continue to ignore what I say. The result would be ignorance and death. Then we have the promise that of judgment, death for rebels and sinners, and redemption or life for the repentant ones. As we see in verse 27-28, he says, Zion shall be redeemed with justice, and repentant ones with righteousness. The destruction of transgressors and of sinners, and those who forsake the Lord shall be consumed. Now, the problem that we're going to see here in chapters 2 through 4 is what Israel is versus what Israel will be. Or another way to say it, we have sinful Israel, their current condition, versus their future condition, God's servant, Israel as the servant of God. Now, we have here what's called as bookends, which I read earlier, is the destiny of the house of Jacob, chapter 2, verses 1 through 5, and Israel restored, chapters 4, 2 through 6. This is what Israel will be. In the middle, which we will discuss next week, is the house of Jacob forsaken, verses 2, 6 through 4, 1. This is what Israel is. For sinful Israel. This is the ideal versus the real. Now, Israel can only fulfill the destiny given to her in chapters 2, 2 through 4 by experiencing the judgment expressed throughout chapters 2, 6 through 4, 1 and the purification described in chapter 4. So God wants them to be What is their destiny? Okay, he's going to tell us what the destiny is, their final outcome. But the outcome has to go through judgment and purification. Oswald, the commentator I'm using on this, says, proud, self-sufficient Israel can become the witness to the greatness of God only when she has reduced to helplessness by his just judgment and then restored to life by his unmerited grace. He is going to restore Israel. And that restoration is based on his grace. They don't deserve to be restored, but he's going to do it anyway. All right, first we're going to see in these verses the destiny of the house of Jacob. What will be? This is the future. This is the mountain of the Lord. We're going to see the mountain of the Lord, the God of Jacob. The word of the Lord, in verse 1, says that Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Now, this is another subscription. We started off in chapter 1, where verse 1, we already heard that this was the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, concerning Judah and Jerusalem, which he saw during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, and the king of Judah. This, again, is another superscription, which is used to enforce or used to introduce an independent prophetic saying or a collection of sayings. It signals the beginning of a specific prophecies after the introduction. So this section is a section of sayings that probably was written down some other time, and now he's going to incorporate it into his larger book. It applies to chapters 2 through 5 within the understanding that a new group of sayings begins then in chapter 6. So he's dividing and showing us the outline of his book. We see here an abrupt shift in mood. You ever heard of a shock jock? You ever heard of a shock jock? You know what a shock jock is? It's a radio talk show host usually, or somebody on the radio, who just says completely outrageous things, right? Some of them use a lot of vulgar profanity and stuff. And people go, oh, wow, what are these? Ah, geez, that's shocking. And then they'll go tell their friends, hey, did you hear what so-and-so said? Yeah, I heard that. Oh, I gotta listen. And they do that in order to, promote their show and so get more people to listen. In a sense, we could say that Isaiah is a shock prophet. He's going to say things that are just totally outrageous. What? How can this be? How is this? How can this possibly be? This is beyond what I was ever thinking. So we see in this abrupt change from the current condition of Israel to the future condition of Israel, what a shocking difference. What a contrast. It's from rebellion to restoration. Now, this section is almost word for word from Micah 4, 1 through 3. And so some commentators say, well, Isaiah was quoting Micah, or Micah was quoting Isaiah, or maybe they were quoting some other person, prophet or so forth. But the point is, as it says in Micah, this was from the mouth of the Lord. Whoever the origination of this, humanly speaking, is not as important as the divine origin of these promises. It comes from the mouth of the Lord. Now, this passage fulfills two functions. It's going to emphasize the certainty of Israel's destiny. The main focus of attention is upon Israel's rebellion, hypocrisy, and injustice. But suddenly here, with no transition at all, the focus is upon Israel's glorious destiny as a lighthouse to the nation for truth and peace. What has happened? Will God forget Israel? Is he going to let them get away with it? How can Israel become Israel? And the second function is to motivate them. Whatever the present may be, however grim the immediate future may be, the distant future signals the Judeans to live in the certainty of what's to come. What would convince the present Judeans to live a life of faithfulness and righteousness than the threat of punishment as the promise of greatness? It's called what we call, I took a course in college once, behavior modification. And you have negative modification and positive modification. You could punish or you can reward, which is, you know, in the whole thing, crux of the class is that rewards and using more positive reinforcements is more productive than using negative reinforcements. So the same thing's here. Isaiah and the Lord's telling them, this is your final destiny. This is what you have been created to be. So let's be what I have created you to be. That's the motivation. Verse 2 says, now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Now, I was looking at a topography map of Jerusalem, and I was looking at, and I noticed that where today would be the Dome of the Rock, where the temple used to be, that the temple, you know, is not at the very top of Mount Zion, which is where Jerusalem is, right? I mean, Rev, you've been there, so you probably familiar with this, but it looks like the temple was kind of like on a downslope of the mountain, and then you had the Kidron Valley, and then you had to the west the Mount of Olives, which looks like a mountain which is even higher than Mount Zion. So Mount Zion isn't even the highest mountain in that range there. But God says in the future, in the latter days, I'm going to raise up this mountain so that it's going to be higher than all other mountains. Now, the latter days is, of course, the eschatos in the Greek would be last things, the last days, which is the future. Now, the question is, when is that going to happen? What future? Is it the millennial age or beyond? Or is it a post-exile? Is it referring to the post-exile of Israel or the church age? Now, yeah, or it could be, is it talking about a literal mountain or is it just simply a figurative thing? Now let's think about when could this possibly have been fulfilled? Could Isaiah, who's giving this prophecy before their exile, everyone knows what the exile is, right? The Babylonians came and deported them to Babylon, okay? And then afterwards, after the first temple was destroyed, they were allowed to return and they began to build another temple, which ended up what we call Herod's temple. It was Zerubbabel's temple, all right? So is this passage referring to that time period? Did this happen? Did the nations during that time period, did they now decide, hey, let's all go to Jerusalem to hear the teachings of the Lord? Well, the history doesn't pan that out because Israel was despised by all, all right? Except for a very few Gentiles who converted into Judaism. No one in the nations would say, hey, well, let's all go up to Jerusalem to learn the ways of the Lord. That didn't happen. So others say, well, it's during the church age. Is it happening? Is the church now the mountain of God? Now, it has to be then, in their estimation, have to be interpreted in a figurative sense. So they'll say, well, there's a partial fulfillment here, not yet. There's three different major views about the coming kingdom. Some would say either it's here, now, it's already here, and we're experiencing the kingdom now, or it's not yet, it's still something in the future, or it's kind of here, but not fully. It's here, but not yet here. And so we're kind of experiencing a little bit of the kingdom, but not all. So in Malachi 1:11, it says, "From the rising of the sun even to the going down, my name shall be great among the Gentiles," God says, "for I am a great king, says the Lord of hosts, and my name is to be feared among the nations." So God and his declaration, his ultimate goal was for not only Israel to become the servants of God, but to bring the nations to him. That's his ultimate God goal. Now, we know from the New Testament, the church was hidden in God. Okay? So, if it was hidden in God, only God knew about this church age that was going to come about. Therefore, he's not then in the Old Testament inserting that idea into these passages. Okay? So, when all the nations says it shall flow to it. And I ask the question, well, when did unbelievers ever just flock to the church? Okay? A lot of empty seats in here. Okay? I don't see people just saying to themselves, hey, let's go to Twin Lakes Baptist. Hey, let's go to, you know, this church or that church, another church, right? We have to go out and many of the churches who are successful, who have big crowds and big, lots of people show up, what do? Well, they have to use a lot of entertainment. They have to use a lot of interesting attractions. They'll use gimmicks or even trickery to get unbelievers in the world to come to church, right? Just to get them to show up. So I don't see the world, this passage being fulfilled today because they're not the one. The world at the time when he says it, it's the unbelievers or the nations who come about after the tribulation period. They're the ones who are going to say, hey, let's go up to the mountain of the Lord. All right. So the church age believers, you know, us, we're told to go into the nations. We should then expect them, we should not expect them to flock to the church and be taught the ways of God. So there has not even, I don't think, a partial fulfillment in literal sense. So its fulfillment is, I believe, is still a millennial future and beyond. He will teach us his ways and we shall walk in his paths. So this is discipleship, right? The coming, their coming to Jerusalem in the mountain of God to be taught is for the purpose of being taught, and that the being taught is then the purpose of walking, that is living. It's during a time of period when people who are there are already believers in the Lord. Okay? They're living in physical, still sinful bodies during the millennial period, and they are still in need of instruction. All right? But they have a trust and a love for God, and therefore they're going to come to Jerusalem and to be taught. And they're going to listen, and they're going to learn, and then they're going to live. They're going to learn how to live right. All right? From out of Zion shall go forth the instruction and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem has become, even today, a symbol of God's self-revelation throughout history. There are not many ways to God, only one way. There is no life apart from him who has revealed himself supremely. People are not going to go to Mecca. They're not going to go to Rome. They're not going to be going to Nepal or India, to the Buddhist temples to discover what the word of the Lord has to say. No, they're all going to be going to Mount Zion, the word of the Lord in Jerusalem. Now, notice that, you know, Trump said he's, and many of others have proposed this, not just Trump, that he was going to try and make Jerusalem the capital of Israel, right? Well, someday, not only will Jerusalem be the capital of Israel, it's going to be the capital of the entire world. Right? So, that's something to look forward to. Now, he shall judge between nations and rebuke many people. And at that time, they will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift the sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. So, in God's story, his story, as Jim mentioned, in his saga, finally, there's going to become an end to conflict. There's not going to be another Star Wars movie. No more Isaiah movie on the growing conflict. The conflict will come to an end. Boom. Now, if, let's say, the Empire did destroy the rebels, and they for a time may have ended conflict, but they were an evil empire, right? And so the people will still have lived under oppression and slavery, and evil and injustice and unrighteousness would still would have prevailed, right? And so there would still need no peace. But when the good guys win, okay, when God wins, okay, he's going to bring an end to it all. You know, if you notice, you ever been in New York City, United Nations building, they have this, I don't know if this is part of on the wall or some monument, but they have those words of Isaiah on the wall over there in New York City. And they have this statue out there along the Hudson River, I believe that is. You might see the, Washington, I think it may be the Washington or Madison Bridge down there in the distance. And there's, a gentleman, finely muscled gentleman, he's turning his sword into a plowshare, right? So the world knows of this promise. And from Psalm 64, God says, "Come and see the works of the Lord, the desolation he has brought on the earth. He makes wars to cease, the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the shields with fire." And in that day, I will make a covenant with them, with the beasts of the field and the birds of the air and the creatures that move along the ground. In Isaiah chapter 11, he talks about how the lamb will lie down with the lamb and the children will be able to play in a viper's pit and a child will lead the, what would be terrifying, animals. Who would destroy and eat you, you know? However, God's going to make a covenant with them. He's going to change their nature and make them no longer violent and so forth. They'll no longer want to eat each other, right? And he says, "Bow and sword and battle I will abolish from the land so that all will live or lie down in safety." Now, before this happened, God's going to do just the opposite. Something just the opposite is going to happen first. Let me turn to Joel chapter 2, verse 3, or verse 8, that's right. It said, "The Lord has spoken, proclaimed this among the nations. Prepare for war. Rouse the warriors," God's saying. "Let all the fighters, men, draw near and attack. Beat your plowshares into swords. Prepare for war. And your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weakling say, 'I am strong. I'm not afraid of going to battle.' Come quickly, all you nations, from every side, and assemble there." And it continues, it says, "Bring down, O Lord, your mighty ones. Let the nations be aroused and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. And there I will sit and judge all the surrounding nations." This would be the Battle of Armageddon. "Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, tread, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes and multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision." So this is the time when God's going to bring the nations together who they think they're going to defeat God, but God's going to defeat them. And then they will be destroyed, and Israel's enemies will be just crushed. And then, as Ezekiel 7:9-10 says, "I will take away the chariots from the Ephraim and the war horses from Jerusalem, and the battle bow will be broken. He will proclaim peace to the nations, His rule will extend from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. The fruit of righteousness will be peace. The effect of righteousness will be quietness and confidence forever. My people at that time will live in a peaceful dwelling places, in secure homes, in undisturbed places of rest. It's certainly stark contrast to Israel today, who have walls all along everywhere, walls everywhere to protect them from missiles and bullets that are constantly being hurled their way. O house of Jacob, this is the admonition here. Come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. In light of what he just said, what are they to do? Peace on earth is only an illusion until people and nations come to the mountain of God to learn his ways and walk in peace, and when the Prince of Peace comes. The admonition here for Israel, and it would be for us, the application, as if the nations are to come to the light we hold, then ought we to walk also in that same light. Israel, at this point, was not walking in the light. They had forsaken God, therefore God had forsaken Israel. And chapter 2, verse 6 says, for another shocking statement from Isaiah, for you have forsaken your people, the house of Jacob. What? They have forsaken God. Now he says, God is going to forsaken them. What is this? So instead of teaching the nations God's ways, Israel was being taught the ways of the world. They were learning dependence on human greatness by Isaiah. But Isaiah shows in chapters 2, 7 through 4, which we're going to look at next week, by a series of stunning contrasts, how such dependence does not exalt man, but actually humiliates. But has God given up on his people? Is all lost? God has abandoned his people. He has forsaken them. Is there no hope for Israel? Is her current sinful condition so great that her future destiny is even beyond reach? In steps Luke Skywalker. In steps the Lord. Israel is restored. There is hope in the Lord. In that day, the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and appealing to those who have escaped. Now notice, it's the branch of the Lord shall be the make them beautiful and glorious. They had, or men have throughout the time, have made attempts to make themselves beautiful and glorious and grand and so forth. But it only results in just the opposite. And the fruit of the earth shall be excellent, appealing to those of Israel who have escaped. The small remnant is going to escape after the destruction. And it shall come to pass that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem, those small remnant that's going to survive God's day of wrath, will be called holy, everyone who is recorded among the living in Jerusalem. This is, I think, this is kind of like the book of life. All those who are in the book of life, who have trusted, will also at that time be called holy. When the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the blood of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. In other words, it's the process of judgment and the process of burning that Israel will experience on the earth at that time. What about us? When we've promised that we all have a day of judgment, that will be the judgment seat of Christ, which will occur in heaven. The church will be judged in heaven, and there'll be a purging of the dross. The hay, wooden stubble will be burnt up, and our works will be determined the value of, and only the good works will remain. So we all, in a sense, have a day of judgment where we will be purged from the sins of our lives. Now, as James said, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Isaiah sees hope through very punishment of sin. The fiery judgment would be a factor in the cleansing process. The purgatory fire is a gift of God. It is through suffering that growth is most achieved. Then the Lord will create above every dwelling place the Mount of Zion, and above her assemblies a cloud and a smoke by day, and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For all the glory will be, there will be his covering. This is to help to establish with Israel a sense of continuity with the past, and let them know that the searing words of judgment did not mean that God has abandoned them completely, and that his ancient covenant is still relevant. God keeps his word. God's ultimate intention is to share his presence with them as intimately as possible. The cloud would speak of God's care for them through protection and guidance. Verse 6, and there will be a tabernacle for shade in the daytime, and from the heat, and from the place of refuge, and from a shelter from the storm and rain. This is to say that nothing in the created universe can harm those who belong to God, who abide with him and walk in his ways. A closing psalm says this, he who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in whom I will trust. Those who abide in the shadow of the Almighty have nothing to fear from the principalities and powers of this world. And this is the vision of Isaiah.